Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on, and that regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass just whatever legislation they like? They are bound by the Overton window. This concept, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any time. Politicians typically only act within a narrow window of policy options. And on the Overton Window podcast, we talk to people who work to shift the Overton window and change what is politically possible. I'm Mike Van Beek, and joining me today is Dave Hebert, who is Director of Economics and Economic Freedom and Senior Research Fellow at the American Institute for Economic Research. Dave lives in Grand Rapids and is a member of the Mackinac Center's Board of Scholars. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, so I wanted to talk about the paper that you've recently worked on American manufacturing.
Yeah.
And how to, you know, improve the situation in the U.S. with regards to manufacturing. So could you explain a little bit about the current state of manufacturing in the U.S.?
Yeah, absolutely. So when it comes to manufacturing in the U.S., there's a lot of what I'll just call misinformation out there. We hear things about how American manufacturers are in decline, how the manufacturing industry is being destroyed or hollowed out. And if you look into the data and you look into what's actually happening around the country, what you find is that the manufacturing sector, in terms of the output that they're producing, is near, if not exceeding, historic highs. It depends on which set of data you want to look at, but in terms of its output, things have pretty much never been greater for the American manufacturing sector. What is in decline, and this is certainly true, is the employment in the manufacturing sector. So we went from having a lot of people in the U.S. working in manufacturing in, say, 1950, and today we have relatively few. In that regard, it's a lot like farming. In 1920, something like 80% of the workforce was in agriculture in some way, shape, or form. Today, it's only about 2%, and yet farm output in the U.S. has never been higher. In fact, we're one of the largest exporters of foodstuffs in the world. Mm-hmm. The same is true for manufacturing. Now, when you listen to the public discourse, people will say things like, oh, the manufacturer, especially here in Michigan, they've just been decimated. Foreign countries have eaten our lunch. We're a weak economy. We're dead. I've got to revitalize this. And that's just not true. The American worker, on a per capita basis, is one of the most productive manufacturing workers in the world, if not the most. The country that people always point to is China. Mm-hmm. China makes about 60% more output in manufacturing than the U.S. But let me ask you a question. How many people are working in the manufacturing sector in China right now?
Many more than the U.S.
Yeah, so it's about 212 to 220 million people in Chinese manufacturing sectors right now, okay? But for comparison, the U.S. as a whole, in every job we have, employs about 157 million, 12.6 million in manufacturing,
yeah.
Okay? So if you look at this, you say, okay, China has 212 to 220 million people working in manufacturing. The U.S. has 12.6. Which country seems like they're going to produce more? Well, it's going to be China.
Yeah.
But the fact that they're only making 60% more stuff than we are, with 200 million more people, that's a testament to how powerful the American worker is. And so the title of my paper is that we need to unleash the American worker on the world, not protect them from the world.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say too, is the approach has been largely looking at the employment numbers in manufacturing, and policymakers, are worried about that. You see the impact of that in some places, like towns that used to be reliant on large segments of the population being employed in the manufacturing sector.
Right.
Right. You've seen the kind of the downturns that those places have experienced. And so the instinct is to protect.
Right.
So why doesn't that work? Why isn't that the best approach?
Right. So this is, the heartfelt and compassionate reaction from policymakers. I never want to call them evil or misguided or, bad people. Mm-hmm. They're actually in there to try to make a difference and to help people. The challenge is that they're not thinking about the long game. They're thinking about from today to the next election. And so what we see are short-term policies designed to protect exactly what is right now without promoting sort of that dynamism that we might want to see. Mm-hmm. So we look at these rural communities in the Rust Belt that have suffered real, you know, economic hardship. And I'll never deny that they're suffering. Okay, so that's certainly true. The challenge, though, is why are they suffering and what can we do to alleviate it? Mm-hmm. And what we see time and again is that in those towns and in those communities, what we find is that in the past, they used very protectionist policies to try to basically shield their dominant industry from competition. Now, this works in the short term, but here's the thing that policymakers never think about. The ground beneath them, the economic, you know, soil that they are working in, is eroding. So what you have is this single industry on a pedestal. And as that ground beneath it continues to crumble, that pedestal is getting higher and higher. Mm-hmm. But what happens if that pedestal were to wobble, if it were to fall over? The collapse is going to be devastating. So one of the projects that I'm also working on the side, it should be coming out sometime soon, is comparing Detroit and Pittsburgh from 1950 to today, right? Yeah. And the reason I do those two is because if you look at them in 1950, both of them were industrial powerhouses. Detroit, obviously, in automotive, steel, or Pittsburgh with steel.
Yeah.
Today, Detroit, while it's on the way back, and I mentioned this in the paper that it's, you know, rebounding.
Yeah.
It had to rebound. Yeah, it had the largest municipal bankruptcy in U.S. history.
It's been a long time in decline.
Right. Yeah, it's been a very long, you know, multiple decades in decline, but they also had multiple decades where state, local, and federal policy all tried to prop up the auto industry. Mm. That just led to less and less resiliency or economic diversity within the city and within the greater metropolitan area of Detroit.
Yeah.
So that when that auto industry collapses, because if there's one thing we know from history, nothing lasts forever. So when that, you know, industry starts to wobble, a lot of people suffer and it's a real hardship. Pittsburgh, by comparison, not a free market, you know, bastion of sanity or anything there, but they had, you know, education, they had tech, they had healthcare, they had industry, they had lots of things in their city and within their community that were independent of steel. Mm. And so when the steel industry there collapsed and when local policymakers through some shenanigans let it collapse, those people in that capital had somewhere else to go. Mm. That wasn't true in Detroit. Now, it's becoming true. Since 2010, we're starting to see more and more economic diversity. There's a lot more resiliency in the Detroit area. So it's very much on its way back up. They just made their final bankruptcy payment last month. Mm. So they're coming back, right? I'm very bullish on Detroit, but it was a bear market for them for a very long time.
Yeah, yeah. The other side of your article is the first part is Unleash the American Worker.
Right.
So what are the kind of policies that we can do to make them even more productive or increase the value of their output?
Yeah. So what the American manufacturing worker in particular needs is access to the materials that they use that, you know, go into their production process. They need trade partners around the world that are not just willing to trade with them, but excited to do so. And they need a government that's going to get out of the way. Now, we're seeing a lot of this happening at the federal level, which is fantastic. President Trump, within the first 48 hours, signed two executive orders, one of which basically said, you know, anytime we want to issue a new regulation, we've got to find 10 that we're going to take off the books, right? The other one was basically saying that anytime we're going to issue a new regulation, it has to go through OIRA for executive approval, basically, right? It really put the executive in charge of what the new regulations were going to be, putting elected officials, you know, overseeing the government, which was lacking for a very long time. And so because of those two, what we've seen over the last, you know, 16, 18 months is actually a tremendous deregulatory effort out of this White House. So the administration likes to point out that they've had 600 some odd deregulatory efforts versus just 5 significant regulatory, you know, burdens imposed. Now, there's some shenanigans about, you know, what counts as a deregulation,
right.
What counts as significant, right? But even the GW regulatory studies at George Washington University, they came out. So they're nonpartisan, they're very, you know, independent, and they're always very critical of basically everything. even they came out and said, look, we disagree with the numbers of, you know, deregulations versus regulations.
Yeah.
But the pattern is this administration has been very deregulatory.
Yeah.
The challenge, of course, is that there are tens of thousands of regulations on the books and they've eliminated about 600. But at the same time, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? So we're getting there, yeah. Right? It's going to take a while to strike all of them at this pace. But for the first time in 50 years, it's actually been a net negative on regulations. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And what's the connection between the regulations and American manufacturing? Like in what ways are the regulations negatively impacting how productive workers can be and things like that?
Yeah. So the thing about regulations is that not only are they rules about what you can and cannot do, but they're also a set of reporting standards. So you have to report and comply and document that you've complied, you know, with these regulations. What we find is that manufacturing workers in particular, and manufacturing firms in particular, are the most affected by regulatory compliance questions. So it's something like $20,000 or more per worker per year in just compliance costs alone for manufacturing. Wow. If you get into the smaller firms where they have fewer than 50 employees, that number jumps up to $50,000 per worker per year.
Wow.
Just assuring that they're complying with federal regulations. That's a lot of money. You know, that's a tremendous amount of money that's not going toward wages. It's not going toward investment. It's not going toward expansion or capital maintenance. It's not going toward anything other than filling out paperwork that someone in Washington, D.C. may or may not look at.
Yeah. And it might not change the way the business actually operates. You know, a lot of these regulations are things that were created decades ago.
Right.
And have become standard practice in the industry now, or because it was already becoming standard practice probably,
yeah.
Or are just not relevant anymore because of maybe a new technology or a new way that they can do things more efficiently, and these regulations don't really matter. I mean, are those some of the ways that they get in the way of the workers and the manufacturing businesses?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my go-to examples on this one, so what we see is, you know, workers tend to like being able to see outside, right? And as we've known from, you know, decades of research and just intuition, a person who's happier at work is more productive, right? They get more things done, they feel better. Everything is just better if they can see outside. Mm-hmm. What's the best way to see outside? Well, have a window.
Yeah.
Do I need a regulation to tell me to have a window? Right? Turns out we've got plenty that say you have to. And so those regulations exist, but that's something a for-profit firm would do on their own volition because they're trying to get more output out of their workers and make them happier to be at work.
Yeah.
Right. But now I've got to document, you know, how many windows do I have? How big are they? How far away from the worker are they? Can they see outside? Are they cleaned regularly such that sunlight is actually coming in? There's all kinds of paperwork involved in just having a window, you know, at the factory, at the office, wherever.
Yeah. There is a good side to this story, too. Obviously, like, these regulations are getting in the way and there's more, you know, there's ways policies could be improved. But maybe we should take a moment and just celebrate the fact that the American workers are incredibly productive.
Absolutely.
Right. So what's the recipe for that? Why does America do well in productivity?
Right. So we do a remarkably good job at being productive. And the reason for it is fairly simple. We have consistent rules for private property that say, you know, hey, if you build a better mousetrap, you're going to get to keep most, if not all, of those profits. We have a system that rewards entrepreneurship. We have a system that rewards collaboration, right? But we also have an incredibly resilient, you know, manufacturing sector in general. Something like 75% of the steel that we use, for example, comes from the U.S. That was true 10 years ago. It's true today, right? And so we have all this capacity, all this knowledge, all these networks that we've built internally and around the world, frankly, to enable our manufacturing workers to be the most productive people on the planet in that sector, okay? And so the danger here is that these are all things that can be taken away through bad policy. But as it stands right now, what we have is, at least in the regulatory front, we have a federal government that is very interested in getting out of the way. This is a tremendous thing because what it says is that Washington implicitly trusts businesses to do the right thing.
Yeah.
To understand that, you know, when you are serving your customers, you're also serving your community. When you're serving, you know, people around the world, you're serving America. These are all things and values, frankly, that we've come to recognize as intrinsically American and have been recognizing them for 250 years.
Yeah, and of course, they're, well, 250 years. So right. Adam Smith pointed these things out 250 years ago
in
the Wealth of Nations, right? Like people have the incentive to act in such a way that benefits them.
Yep.
But in that very doing that, they benefit others at the same time. And so we get these positive spillover effects. And, you know, it seems like reducing regulations is also recognizing the incentives that are already in place for people to behave in socially positive ways. And we don't need, actually, a government rule or a bureaucrat to come down and tell us how to put in windows. Because we would do that ourselves because it's good for us and it's good for our fellow humans as well. So it's like an added bonus.
Right. So, you know, Adam Smith writes in The Wealth of Nation that mankind has a natural propensity to truck, barter, and exchange, right? And that's the human condition, at least in America, is to find ways to serve others because that's how we serve ourselves, right? He opens the book with a parable, if you will, about the butcher, the baker, and the brewer, right? Why do they, you know, bake our bread, you know, give us our meat, brew the beer for us? It's not because they love us. They do, right? But it's because of their own self-interest, right? So when we have this system that basically says, if you want to better your own condition, which Adam Smith identifies as a fundamental force of human nature, right? If you want to better your own condition, what better system could we have that incentivizes you to better your condition by bettering your fellow man?
Right.
A lot of people say, you know, we just need to work together. And I look at the world and say, yeah, and we're doing that. That's exactly what we're doing right now is we're working together toward the betterment of society. My motives might be, you know, getting my kid a better toy or sending them to a better school to be more, you know, altruistic.
Yeah. Right?
But really it's, you know, my kids are 6 and 4. So like the better toy is what I'm
it's after, definitely right? Yeah.
But, you know, later in life, I want to send them to a better school. Well, to do that, I need to get more money. How do I get more money? Well, I do things that are productive for other people, right? Yeah. The way to get rich in America is not by hoarding wealth. It's by serving other people. And that's like the American dream.
Yeah. And so I wonder about thinking about manufacturing being productive and the productivity of the American worker. In a lot of the policy conversations about manufacturing and about the economy in general, actually, we focus a lot on employment numbers.
Yeah.
How many people are employed? How many people are unemployed, looking for work, the percentages, all that stuff, labor force participation. Should we focus more on productivity? Should we talk about the productivity per worker in manufacturing and maybe even in some other sectors? Would that be a better way of gauging kind of the health of the industries?
Yeah, I think that would be a better way. You know, the danger, of course, is we don't want to think only about productivity and how much output we're, you know, making, right? We want to think about the quality of life that people have, right? So this is, again, to circle back to Adam Smith, the full title of his book is An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations, right? So what he's doing is he's asking a question, you know, what is wealth? Prior to Adam Smith, for 500 years before him, people thought that having money was the goal, right? If you have more money, then you're wealthier. And that's true of a household. But when you apply it to a nation, what you find is that you accumulate, you know, vast sums of gold.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have as much stuff. So you have a lot of gold, not a lot of stuff. That means the gold price, or in today's terms, the money price, is going to go up, right? And that's going to be a really big problem, right? And so what Adam Smith writes about, and he basically reversed everything, is he says, look, money is important. You got to have money. But what matters most is what you can do with that money, right? Mm-hmm. Tom Hanks in the movie Castaway, if he washed ashore with, you know, one of President Obama's $1 trillion coins that he was floating around, he wouldn't have lived a better life, right? He would have had a cool, shiny circle, and that'd be great. But it wouldn't have helped him, you know, when his tooth got infected. He still would have had to knock it out with that ice skate. Yeah. If you can't tell, I just watched the movie a couple of weeks ago, right? So it's about 20 years old at this point. But that's the point is, you know, money by itself is not good. Mm-hmm. Money is only good when you can do something with it.
Right.
And that's the beauty of, you know, focusing on consumption in this case, is that we focus not on production per se from a policy standpoint. Obviously, that's a relevant thing. Mm-hmm. But we focus on, you know, what can you do with the output that you've produced? You sell it for money. That's great. What can you do with that money? And if you can do more things, then you must be living a better life.
Yeah. It seems like part of this story has to be, too, the technological innovations that we have. And I mean, I don't know the measures of these kinds of things, or if there are measures, but it seems like the U.S. is, you know, one of the most technologically advanced countries in the world, probably, you know, at the very top. So how does that play into this as well? And what are the policy implications of the impact that technology has?
Yeah. So what technology does is it helps workers do more with less time. It's a labor-saving, you know, tool, mm-hmm. right? And think about, you know, your own life with a computer, with the internet, right? You know, you and I are old enough that we remember going to the library and having to get books. And now we're just like, hey, Google, or hey, ChatGPT, right? What's the answer? And it's pretty good at telling you, right? It's not perfect, but it's pretty good. And so what technology really does is it makes it so that less labor is necessary to achieve the same output. And we see this, you know, in every sector. The one that's really interesting to me is actually the longshoremen, right? Mm. So the longshoremen in their contract have basically banned AI and automated cranes and all these other things. As a result, it takes a lot more labor in the U.S. to get things on and off ships at the ports than it does in, say, China. Right. So where are, you know, most of the top 100 most productive ports in the world in terms of, you know, labor hours and like what's getting on and off the boats? They're in China. Right. They're not in America. There's only like three or four ports in the U.S. that are in that top 100. Right. And so that's a remarkable thing. So when you block technology from coming in, what you're really doing is saying, I want to make it more expensive to get this thing done.
Mm-hmm.
For the longshoremen, what's happening there is, anything that comes into or goes out of the U.S. on a boat, which is basically every import and export, is now going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
That's a hidden tax on everything that we do, especially manufacturing, right? They get a lot of their raw materials from around the world. They get machined, you know, inputs and intermediate goods that we like to call them from around the world that they then use to make the amazing things like cars, like airplanes. When those all get more expensive, we can do less of them than we could. So that's, you know, a government regulation getting in the way of the most productive people on the planet. It's saying, hey, I don't want you to have as much stuff. I want you to do more and have less available to do it with. That's going to be really hard. And despite all these things being thrown in their way, the American manufacturing worker continues to dominate the world on a per capita productivity basis.
Yeah, I wonder, too, if the types of things that are being made in the U.S., if that makes a difference. I was talking with my colleague James Holman about this, and, you know, he was pointing out that there's a lot of things that are produced in the U.S. Are not consumer products.
Yeah.
So they're like large, sophisticated, complex machines that we export to other countries because they don't have the capital, the technology to build them over there. Right. And that's, these things are really expensive, but no one buys them in the US, you know, except businesses or something like that. But because we just don't see that as much, I wonder if that's why we have this, you know, the narrative about generally people feel like the manufacturing sector is declining because they're looking at employment levels. Or, I mean, even hear people say things like, you know, we don't make it anything here anymore.
Right.
Well, we do. It's just you don't see it.
Yeah. So in terms of our manufacturing output, you know, let's use a car, for example, right? The average person drives a car for something like 10 to 13 years now, right? So that's one purchase every 10 to 13 years.
Yeah.
Right. How many shirts have you bought in the last year? I'm guessing it's more than one.
Yeah.
Right.
So accidentally,
right? But those are from, you know, Mexico, India, Indonesia, China, right? Taiwan. They're from all over.
Yeah.
So when you look at the product labels, it's no mystery to me that it feels like a lot of the things on a, you know, item by item basis are coming from far flung corners of the world. They are, mm-hmm. right? Our coffee comes from, you know, South America, right? There's all kinds of things that come from all over the world. And it's true, you know, we do buy more products from all over the world on a product by product basis, right? Mm-hmm. That's true. And we are still exporting a lot of manufactured goods around the world as well. A lot of big equipment, a lot of medical equipment actually is made here in America and then shipped to hospitals all over the world. Mm-hmm. Why is that? Well, because we have the engineering and technical know-how of how to make it. And, you know, how many MRI machines do we need in the U.S.? A lot.
Yeah.
But other people need them too.
Yeah, right? Right, yeah.
And so, like, we want to have more customers around the world, because here's the really crazy thing. There's 8 billion people in the world. There's only 330 million Americans. So if you want to have more customers, most of them are out there. Mm-hmm. So we want to be able to trade with those people, because that's where the people are. Most of them don't live in America.
Yeah. I think, I wonder if you could think a long term in the future here. So, you know, it'll get a little bit dicey maybe.
Yeah.
But you're brave.
Sure.
So I was wondering about, you know, will the U.S. always have, do you think, will we always have a manufacturing industry like this, and maybe even a strong one? Could we assume that? I mean, the U.S. has had a strong manufacturing industry for a long time.
Yeah.
Do you think that will continue? Or what do you think along those lines?
No,
long term.
Yeah, long term. So what we see as economies develop is they become, you know, less focused on manufacturing in terms of employment levels. What we're also seeing, especially in the U.S., is that even with a declining, you know, level of employment in manufacturing, we're still building more. I would expect that that trend is going to continue as long as government stays out of the way, right? Which is a big ask in mm-hmm. terms of Washington and, in our case, Lansing,
yeah.
right? But as long as government stays out of the way, I would expect that that trend will continue. Does that mean that, you know, manufacturing is always going to be in the U.S.? I don't know. I don't want to make that claim. But at least for the next, you know, 10, 50, possibly even 100 years, yeah, I think the U.S. manufacturing sector is going to continue to be robust. It's going to continue to lead the world. It's going to continue to be the place where new inventions come out. The rest of the world then has to catch up on and improve on, right? This is what we see out of, you know, China, Germany, UK, a lot of Europe in general.
Yeah.
Right? We invent the new thing. They kind of polish it up, if you will.
Okay.
Right? And so that's a great system, right? We're leading the world on what the future is going to look like. They help make it a little bit brighter.
Yeah.
I think that's still going to be true for America. The question, of course, is for how long, and will government stay out of the way?
Yeah. And you can make a case that it's a really positive future, because, as you said, there's 8 billion people out there, and those are, and they're growing richer too,
right?
On average, by the day, year by year. And so, you know, the market for the kinds of sophisticated things that we can manufacture here in the U.S. is going to just continue to grow.
Right. You know, as the rest of the world kind of catches up to where we are. So look, we're one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Like, that's just true. There's no metric by which we're not. And so as the rest of the world catches up to, you know, our level of, dare I say, opulence, that's just more people that will be able to afford the great things that we're making. And as that continues, that's going to breed more opportunities for American workers. And so I think the future for America is very bright. I think the future for the American manufacturing sector is very bright, provided, of course, government stays out of the way.
Yeah. All right. It's a good place to stop. Thanks, Dave, for being on the podcast.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.